Hey everyone, welcome to the holiday episode of What a Hell of a Way to Die. We're here to celebrate the 4th of July, Independence Day, the day that that this great monolith of a nation stepped foot and said, no more to the British rule. We will fucking own slaves and do shit our own way. And we will not let the British tell us what to do. No taxation without representation. Thank God, and we will go blow our hands off in celebration for it. Gentlemen, how are you doing?
Great.
I'm doing phenomenal.
So, Adrian, what do they do for the 4th of July out in the Ukraine? Out in Ukraine.
Sorry. In Ukraine. No problem. It's more important that I get that right than you, so I don't get beaten by angry, rightfully angry Ukrainian nationalists. Yesterday, the America House in Kyiv held a 4th of July barbecue party. This is one of the big events in Kyiv during the year. Like, the line always stretches blocks, no exaggeration. And apparently, I'm not sure exactly why this is, given that America House is supposed to be an area of sort of cultural expansion. You're trying to share American traditions with Ukrainians. But if you've got an American passport, you get to cut to the front of the line. That doesn't seem fair.
I would just say that perhaps if the word has gotten out that American barbecue is just that fucking good, then maybe that is the best possible cultural exchange. Like, you thought you were just going to have pickled beets or whatever the hell, but instead you're getting pulled pork and all this nonsense that takes hours to make, because this is what we do in America. Like, we slaughter pigs and we sit in hot weather and drink alcohol.
Exactly. Yeah.
And there's a great video, if you haven't seen it, of when you're deployed, one of the greatest days is the surf and turf day, where you get lobster tails and steak. Now you think, oh wow, how great! It's not great lobster tails and steak, but it is lobster tails and steak, or crab legs, or something along those lines. And there's this great video of a forward operating base in which the cooks are outside grilling steaks while the mortars are going off, and there's a firefight going on because there's like, look, you don't fuck with steak night. You don't fuck with surf and turf, and you don't fuck with American barbecue. I don't give a fuck who's shooting at me. These guys got it. I'm going to go ahead and cook these steaks.
It's like barbecue takes about 5, 6, 8 hours to make. You know, it's a long time. Like, this tick isn't going to last that long. Like, maybe 90 minutes, but probably less. We'll have counter fire. You know, they'll set up some Apaches and fuck things up. But, like, we cannot let the barbecue timeline get messed up.
Nope. You can't. You can't deviate. So we're going to try to be a little bit more fun today, since this is a holiday episode, and we're going to talk about a few different things that are near and dear to our heart. Number one being a place that every troop finds himself in, the quote-unquote field. So, Nate, tell me, what is the field?
Well, the field is when you're in a training area, when you're sent out to a training exercise, and typically you're not allowed to go back to home station until everyone goes back, unless it's like a quick admin visit back. But you all of a sudden, your company element, your battalion element, whatever you want to call it, whatever unit is out doing the training, is in a training area. And it could be a few kilometers down the road on base. It could be in a different country. But you're on a training exercise, and so the rules change. You're no longer in your normal barracks or quarters. You're in wherever they put you, in a great big clamshell tent, in hard stand buildings, in a fucking tent in the woods, Arctic 10-man tents in the middle of the tundra with little weird wood-burning stoves. Could be anything. And you're out training, and the schedule's different. Life is different. You're typically not doing PT or physical training, or if you are, it's sort of improvised and ad hoc. Adrian's looking at me funny because he's like, wait a minute, you don't do PT. I'm a company commander. You always fucking do PT. Like, I don't care where you are. Pick up logs in the forest and lift them. See, that's the kind of thing that you're trying to hide from. But long story short, you're out. You're not getting to fuck off at the end of the day. You're not getting weekends. You're training. And even it being the U.S. Army, some of the training will be intense, but a lot of times it's a lot of waiting and wasted time or preparation and, you know, things that you're trying to do to get yourself squared away before you do your training event, whatever it might be, whether it's we're doing a ruck march out on the trail, or we're doing like an actual live fire range and all the preparation into it. But the field brings with it a lot of stuff, a lot of things like eggs made from powder that served at breakfast and cases of UHT milk that soldiers challenge themselves to who can drink the most milk without throwing up, things like that. You find yourself in a whole different world, and everyone's got field stories. So That being said, whenever we talk about it, when we talk about the field, we're not really talking about being in combat. It's just a whole different thing. We're talking about being at home station or being not combat forward deployed and out doing training.
Yeah, and if you're not in the military, if you're a civilian, I oftentimes talk about how war is actually super boring for the most part. You always hear that quote that war is a lot of sitting around and waiting, interspersed with moments of pure terror. Now that is the field, but just completely take out the pure terror. You're out there doing, you know, training lanes and things like that, but holy shit is a lot of sitting around and waiting and doing nothing. And probably the most dangerous thing out in the field is a bored private. It's some E2 or E3, 19 years old, you know, got a little money in his pocket. He's out here. Can't get a beer. He can't play his video games. So he's got to find a way to entertain himself.
So I'm going to tell a field story since that's the whole point of this. I was at Donnelly Training Area in Alaska, in the interior of Alaska in 2008. My battalion was doing a rotation prior to going to the National Training Center in California, which is basically being in the field, but even more. So we were up at Donnelly for like 3 weeks. And in an airborne infantry company, you have three airborne, like light weapons companies, light companies, where it's light infantry, paratroopers, et cetera. And then you have a DECA, or your Delta company, is actually your heavy weapons company. So they have more vehicles, they have tow missiles, they have 50 caliber machine guns. And the tow missile is pretty expensive munition. So when you get a chance to shoot it, I mean, lots of soldiers will go through training exercises to how you train on the optic. But actually firing a live tow missile is kind of a rare thing. So we got to fire live tow missiles, except one of them didn't detonate. It just sort of plopped down in the field. So we had to clear the dunnage, right? We had to clear the UXO, the unexploded ordnance, before we could keep training. In walks our battalion command sergeant major. Love the guy, but he had some unorthodox opinions on unexploded ordnance. And he said, we're not fucking shutting down this stupid thing. This thing's inert. Let's just get rid of it. So he and the DECO first sergeant, taking orders from the sergeant major, of course, walk out into the range fan and pick up this unexploded tow missile and take it to the dunnage truck and just put it in the truck. And they're like, yeah, just drop this off at Fort Wainwright with the dunnage. So private being a specialist driver, private, whatever, they get in the vehicle. And when the training range is done, they drive to Fort Wainwright and fucking open up the thing at the ammo point. And there's an unexploded tow missile in the back of the truck. The holy death missile that could probably explode a tank, is there just sitting there sort of chilling in the back of the truck. And so needless to say, we got a lot of mandatory re-education that was extremely awkward because it was mandated to us as though it was soldiers who had fucked up, but actually the senior most enlisted soldier in the battalion had been the one who made the decision. And that's the kind of thing that never happens in garrison because you don't have live tow missiles. It just wouldn't happen. That's why the field is weird, because it's like all of a sudden the bullets might be real and really dumb things can happen.
Yeah. My first annual training, when I was 19 years old, was out at Fort Irwin. We never went to the sandbox, but we were covering, I'm public affairs. I've always been public affairs. We were covering all of the logistical stuff that was going, that was taking place to get people that go out into the training environment, go out to the box. So I'm 19. It's still America, so you can't drink or anything. But, the barracks that we're in, we're with a mechanic unit from the Virgin Islands, and we walk in, and the first room on the left was where the commander and the first sergeant were sharing a room, and they had their duffel bags and everything, but they also had one duffel bag that they opened up, and it was filled with nothing but Virgin Island rum and like padding so that they could ship it and get it here without it getting broken. So they were always having their own little, they were having a couple of drinks. They were never getting torn up. But the end of annual training, and annual training is only 2 weeks, but the end of AT party that they decided to have, they had seafood stew, they had all kinds of, they just fantastic. And they broke out this huge thing. They made a jungle juice that was just filled with rum. So I go up to the first sergeant and I said, look, first sergeant, I am 19 years old. I don't want to get anybody screwed over here. And, so if you don't want me to drink, I won't. And he says, in the Virgin Islands, you only have to be 18 to drink. I see you without a drink. I kick you out the fucking party. That's not the first time I've ever been drunk, but that's the first time I've ever been that drunk. Because
island drunk,
God. And then the thing is, the worst part was, is that Fort Irwin is a 3-hour drive away from Vegas. Our flights were the next day at 7 a.m. So we were drinking until about 2 a.m. and then had to pile into SUVs to drive to the airport.
I'm just going to say many a soldier has got a drunken night at Fort Irwin and had to take a fucking long ass bus ride to either Ontario, California or Las Vegas and has puked everywhere. I was on a bus full of ROTC cadets who made that same mistake. So it is a famous fate to befall American soldiers. Sorry, Adrian.
No, not at all. So this is not exactly a field story. It's a post-field story. Not just a post-field story, but a post-field rolling into leave story. When I finished National Guard pre-Ranger training, and this is a really good set of training that, like, when I was on Fort Benning, it was tough to get into as a lieutenant. It was kind of a backdoor into Ranger school, because if you passed this 2 weeks, basically you went through Darby's phase, the first phase of Ranger school, before doing the real one. It was really useful. So if you pass it, you get a guaranteed slot to Ranger school. It seems kind of silly in retrospect, in the sense that, like, if you pass Ranger school, you get a guarantee, like a mini Ranger school, you get a guaranteed pass to Ranger school. But it, in fact, it really does make sense. So I just finished this pre-Ranger training, which was hellacious and in certain ways harder than the first part of Ranger school. They do everything except starve you, and they smoke. The smoking was harder. I got smoked harder in pre-Ranger than I was smoked in Ranger school. So it was a really awful experience. Definitely didn't want to go through it again. I felt, you know, I passed both of my field exercises, one of which was a reconnaissance, and one of which was a raid. Everybody had had a really awful time. We'd been in the field for 5 days, no sleep, just, you know, zonked out of our minds, really looking forward to being free again for a couple days before we went to real Ranger school for who knew, you know, 2 months, 5 months, 9 months. I made it through first time go, but I was very, very lucky in that. So here I am right before 1.5 days of leave, beautiful, sweet, sweet leave. And me and my buddy, I went through with 12 other lieutenants, one of whom was a good friend of mine. And we get our we get our graduation certificate, get our passes. We're free to go. Friends picking us up. We go up to the locker room, the bay, with all these giant lockers, which are there for each locker thing held sufficient space for 2 people to store their gear. And we're free. We're going. We're on our way out. And there are a few other guys who are in the bay, and they're just shooting the shit, bullshitting. One of the other people who's in the bay leans against one of the lockers, and the bay is arranged in sort of like a horseshoe with the bunk beds in front of the lockers. So there's nothing really keeping the lockers from each other. They're arranged really, if you can imagine it, like a giant set of dominoes. Well, this guy leans on the locker. The locker hits the next locker behind it and knocks all of the other lockers down. It sounds like a bomb going off. It's like massive metal lockers falling. And we look around and we're like, we see like the devastation. Nobody gets hurt. We're just looking around. And me and my buddy, we look at each other, and I'm very proud of this. I said, we need to leave now. We need to leave now, because you know what's happening. What's happening next is a Ranger instructor is coming back
somewhere. Someone going, what the fuck?
Yes. And then leave gets canceled somehow. So we rolled right the fuck out of there. And it just so happened that our friend was driving up at about the same time that we saw 2 Ranger instructors like running into that bay. So we were leaving and they were coming in, and we got our 1.5 days of leave, is the long story short. But that was, I saw that. I saw some sergeant rolling in there, and we escaped. That's, leave is very important. If I don't know if we want to do the segue now or after your point, Nate, but.
Yeah, you don't want to screw somebody's pass up. Like, God, I can't think of a bigger buddy fuck move than someone's about to go on leave or about to go on pass, and you do something that gets everybody screwed over. I mean, invariably, somebody's going to do something stupid, and you might get recalled. The whole company, like, imagine if you were in your regular civilian job, and, like, someone at your company got a DUI, so they made everybody at the company come to show up to work during the vacation and fucking made you do push-ups. Like, that is that's a risk hanging over everyone's head if they're in an active-duty Army unit or in a guard unit that's on training. So I have a story of we need to leave now. I was in Korea and we were doing gunnery in the winter, which gunnery for a mechanized unit, basically imagine marksmanship training and all the things that go into getting a soldier qualified on a rifle and all the preparatory things and range setup. But then you also have to do it for tanks and for big armored fighting vehicles. And so it just takes weeks. Whereas like you could shoot in every weapon system in an airborne infantry battalion in about 2 weeks of training and have everyone qualified as long as they've done their homework and they're not fuck ups. But for tanks, it takes much longer. I mean, it can be done in 14 days straight, but like there's just not enough training land in South Korea to make that happen. So our gunneries were like anywhere from 4 to 6 weeks, depending on the time of year and how complex it was getting. And so we were doing the winter gunnery, and an artillery unit had fired misfired a 155 millimeter Paladin, like a self-propelled 155 millimeter howitzer. It's one of the biggest, basically, cannons that's not a tank barrel in the U.S. Army. And it had landed, a couple of shots had landed in a bunch of fucking places, and no one was hurt, but they had to send their battalion operations officer to do an investigation. He had to go to every potential point of impact and investigate and write it up in his report. So there he was on the way to one with him and his driver, and this is really sad. Like, they just disappeared. The Blue Force tracker just disappeared. Nobody knew what happened. They literally called a dust one, a duty status whereabouts unknown, which I'm very familiar with because I was in a unit where, famously, a guy named Bo Bergdahl became a dust one. But he vanished, and they started searching for him, and they literally couldn't find them. And so the next day they sent out rescue divers, and they found the Humvee at the bottom of a lake that it had, crossing a pontoon bridge, had popped off the railings on ice, and both this major and his corporal driver had drowned. And so,
oh my God.
So they were dead, and they were doing casualty notification at, you know, in Korea. And so in the environment of, oh my God, we just had people die in training. A tank company is getting ready to do gunnery, and one of the Bradley companies had some soldiers that were back in the rear, the not training area, but the main base, when you get rotated back if you have like an appointment or something. So these soldiers had missed their day to shoot SAW gunnery, the M249, or SAW range, not gunnery, but you know what I mean. They had to qualify on the light machine guns, and they'd missed the day the company was doing it, they hadn't qualified, so they had to go back. But when the company was shooting their SAW gunnery or their SAW range, they were shooting on the tank range on a modified range table. You know what I mean? Like, you have a great big training area, big enough to accommodate tank rounds. So you can carve out an area and be like, all right, we're going to shoot machine guns here because you've got the space. So their NCO, kind of being a dumbass, was just like, yeah, just go back to where we were shooting last week. You know, they had to reshoot, right? So they go out to berm number 3 on the tank training range, not realizing that there's a tank company about to qualify on that range. So you get the picture. Here are these two plucky privates with their SAW M249 light machine guns out on the third battle position of a range that's going to be fired on with tanks with live rounds. So the tanks go out to start shooting, and they're literally doing coax gunnery, right? They're firing their fucking coaxial 50 caliber machine guns, bullets that can shoot down planes. They're meant to shoot down planes. And then all of a sudden, they see waving on the range. And he's just like, don't shoot us, guys. It's poncho liner. They're waving the whoopee. Here's two privates. Now, this is a unit that literally, in our brigade, we've just had two people die accidentally. Needless to say, range control, which is controlled by civilians, is like, holy shit, safety stand down. Calls just fucking safety stand down. Everything is stood down. And the brigade commander has to come out. Now, the brigade commander has just come from doing a casualty, real-world casualty notification for the spouses of people who have died in his brigade. So we are running a great big training exercise as well, and so we have to have 24-hour talk ops. And so in the room adjacent to basically the battalion S1 area, the battalion admin area, like a personnel admin area, is the sleep quarters for officers, because they had to set it up that way because guys were rotating, they were doing different shifts, and like you have guys who have to do night shifts, so it doesn't make sense to have... It's made more sense to have all the guys that were going to be battle captains and running the talk on the staff exercise segregated. So all of our night shift guys are sleeping, and I hear some screaming, and I'm like, what's going on? One of my soldiers is like, holy shit, sir. The brigade commander just locked up the battalion commander outside and was fucking ripping his ass. And then I hear the thunder, and that is our brigade commander comes into the battalion S1 where he's gathered all the company commanders in the battalion. And he's like, "You motherfucker!" And just losing his mind. And I think, "Oh my God." And I wake up all the lieutenants and captains who are night shift guys. I'm like, "Get your shit on. Get out. You have to get out of this room. We have to get out right the fuck now." Because he doesn't know. He doesn't know that you're night shift. He's just going to walk in here fucking flipping desks and be like, "Why are these captains sleeping?" And it's just one of these moments where you're like, "Oh my God, I can see the future right now. I know exactly what's going to happen. Like, I don't care that it's December in Korea. Put your shit on. Get the fuck outside now. We've got to go now."
Yeah.
And it's like, to this day, it's weird how that'll happen where it's not even training. It's just like a combination of things. You're like, "Oh God, this is going to be bad. I've got to stop it."
Yeah. And along with, you know, not fucking with somebody's leave or fucking with pass, I graduated basic training September, I want to say 14th or 15th, 2011 or 2001. So, you know, 9/11 happened in that week between like you're done and then you're prepping for graduation. There's usually a couple of days there when you're done doing all the dumb bullshit out in the field. You do that final FTX. So it comes down from the command. You know, we've all got a, like, nobody knew what the fuck to do after 9/11, especially like at Fort Benning. So it was, we were pulling guard with M16s with no magazines and no rounds, like dirty M16s that they just pulled out of the armory. And they're just like, "Stand here and like guard against something. Fuck it. I don't know." Just, it's just like, we need to do something. So graduation comes along. They give you, you know, your family comes and they're like, "Hey, you can go ahead and get off post." If you don't have family coming, with, you know, me and, you know, plenty of people didn't have family making that trip to Georgia, you could, you know, generally just take pass for the day. You call up the local cab company. They're always there. They know that there's a bunch of privates who are just getting out of basic training with a bunch of money in their pocket. So the drill sergeants tell us, like, "Okay, it's come down that you can only leave the base if you have family to take you." Now, they're like, "Okay, we know, like, half of you don't have family. So we're going to allow your battle buddy's family to sign you out." So families come, and not to be like I was, you know, super unpopular, but the people who I was close with, all of us didn't have family coming. So nobody had a family that could sign all of us out. So everybody is left the bay. There's probably about 6 or 8 of us who are still left feeling like shit, because like the first time any of us would be able to get off post, get a cigarette, get a soda, get a burger, not get yelled at by a drill sergeant has just gone out the window. And the drill sergeant walks in and he's like, "What the fuck are you all doing here?" And they're like, "Well, we didn't have anybody's family to sign us out." He's like, "Get the fuck off this post right now and don't come back until, you know, I think it was like 2000. Like, just fucking go. What are you doing? Like, nobody, just go. We just started war. Go have a goddamn burger at Chili's." So I always appreciated that, like, that the drill sergeants, no matter what, they still had that heart of just get off post because shit's about to be fucked up for a while.
Yeah, it's kind of amazing that Osama bin Laden almost fucked you out of a pass, but you were able to remedy that. I mean, I think he fucked a lot of people out of passes in the grand scheme of things, but at least yours was fixed in that brief span of time.
Yeah, you know,
and so
you just have to have one drill sergeant who was 3 months away from he was on his last rotation and 3 months away from retiring who did not give a fuck.
I mean, everyone's got one of those. I mean, I can only imagine what that'd have been like to be like, I'm almost done with basic training, but now, oh shit, there's a war. I was just going to talk about pass too, because something that is not always communicated to civilians is that the military has, it's strict with regard to personal freedom, but there are also mandated periods of not training and not work that are kind of surprising. You have 30 days paid vacation a year. You also get 4-day passes, 4-day weekends. Now, whether or not you get a pass that lets you leave post is one that depends on your command, depends on what's happening, on your, a lot of times on your rank too. But for government holiday weekends, for like Martin Luther King's birthday, President's Day, Memorial Day, the 4th of July, Labor Day, Columbus Day, Veterans Day, Thanksgiving, Christmas, and New Year's, you have 4-day weekends. You have, when you have a government holiday on a Monday, you typically either get Tuesday or the previous Friday off. So you have this bizarre phenomenon of 96 hours of no work that just occurs periodically, regardless of where. I mean, it doesn't happen when you're deployed typically. Like, I don't know of anybody that ever got 4-day passes while deployed. Like, that doesn't happen. But it's kind of a sacred institution, I think. The idea of your 4-day weekend, it is a sacrosanct thing. And it's kind of bizarre because you think about an organization that will literally threaten to send you to military jail if you wear the wrong hat. And yet you have this massive period of downtime. And but a lot goes into it. A lot of things can happen to fuck you out of your pass or your 4-day, to include a recall because someone screwed up, or because you're in training, or because it gets kanked. Like, a lot of things can happen. I've seen good and bad. But basically, almost everywhere I've been that's not combat, they have respected the sanctity of that 96-hour pass. And so I would defer to Adrian, the former company commander, to talk about that.
Yeah, I've been trying to think when we brought up the idea of discussing this, what the strangest thing I saw was. And I think most of, you know, I didn't experience any problems with this as a commander. So I'm just going to punt on that. I will say that all of the strange things that I saw will probably be similar to the things that you guys saw, both as enlisted or as people serving OCONUS deployments or OCONUS postings to Alaska or Korea, which is that, like, people, you know, game the system all the time. I was in Italy. So my first posting was to Italy as a lieutenant. And what I saw mostly on 4-day passes was people being treated like adults and abusing that and then getting everybody else in trouble. There was this one lieutenant, something happened. I don't remember what happened. There was somebody, I think some soldier got got jumped by some other soldiers, got hazed. And so this triggered a congressional from the soldier's father. Not surprisingly, I think that's fair. And in response to this, the battalion commander said, everybody come back on post. And it turned out that, like, a couple lieutenants, one of whom was just pathologically incapable of doing the right thing. It was not me, by the way, surprisingly enough. It was our chemo. It was our goddamn chemo. He was in Greece and had told nobody that he was going to Greece. It's not, this is one of those things where it's like, you know, if you decided when I was in Fort Drum, if you decided to, like, drive down to New York City, you know, 5.5-6 hour drive, if you were caught out, if you were outside that bubble, which New York City most certainly was outside the bubble, you could always just jump in a car, or worst case scenario, like, you know, pay somebody $500 to drive you back to Fort Drum and be there 6 hours later. Like, and people could cover for you, say, whatever. But if you're in Greece, like, out of cell phone range, like, out of just like gone, gonzo, you know, and nobody knows that you're in Greece, the fuck are you going to do? So that, I think that's probably the weirdest four-day pass thing that I saw that affected me. And the effect of that being that, like, before that, nobody had to fill out any paperwork. It was big boy rules. After that, constantly, anytime you had even like a 1-day pass, like if you were driving to Verona, which was technically outside the bubble, you had to get a goddamn pass, which is a hassle.
Korea is like that 100%. And I think it's one because of the fact that Korea, it's such a sensitive area to be stationed, because we've pissed off the Koreans so much that anything, they want to keep maximum control on soldiers, because basically it's a cover your ass thing. Because if your soldier is the one who manages to get us kicked off the peninsula for good, you want to have a really, really long and thick paper trail to show that it's not your fault. So you basically can't go anywhere in Korea without a pass. It's incredibly rare. You can't go to Seoul without a pass, which is like an hour train ride away. And there's a subway station right out the front of Camp Casey. I'd always heard that in Italy and in Germany that, like, you literally could just put, like, Britain on your DA-31 on your leave form, your pass form, and, like, they wouldn't really care. Whereas, like, I literally had a company commander who, if you went on pass in Seoul, like, there was a curfew, and he wouldn't go out on Friday or Saturday nights because he wanted to call people's phone numbers that they had on their pass forms just to confirm they were actually, he literally did that, and then would make the soldiers pass the phone around so he'd check off the checklist to see if all 4 or 5 people that were on, like, the buddy form, like, if they were all in the room together. It was, and on one side, you're like, that's paranoid and insane. On the other side, like, there was a unit in Korea where, like, soldiers went out and got drunk and, like, got in a fight and like beat one of their fellow soldiers and just sort of like left him outside of a Korean hospital, just like went back to post. I mean, like these sorts of things would happen. So the level of control required was insane. Like I can kind of see from both angles. But it's amazing how restrictive it can get. And also in Korea, I think the second reason why it's so restrictive is because you're like a 3-hour flight away from like a bunch of war zones in that country. And so you can get yourself in a lot more trouble. We had a NCO that didn't tell anyone he was going to the Philippines to go visit his family. And then that huge typhoon hit. And so all of a sudden they're like, oh, whoops, by the way, you have a soldier that you can't get a hold of because he might have died in a typhoon in the Philippines and you didn't know he was there.
You know, Nate, that's a great story about the Philippines. It brings in mind a movie I watched once about retaking the Philippines based on Doug MacArthur's promise that one day he would return. And I've been thinking about movies a lot recently, war movies in particular, because A, War Machine came out, and B, I watched, I don't know if anybody else has seen this, Generation War, from, this is the English translation of the title, Unser Vater, Unser Mutter. It's sort of like the German Band of Brothers, which, anyway, I recommend it, but it's not, it's no Band of Brothers. And it's really put me in a frame of mind where I'm thinking a lot about good movies to be told about Iraq and Afghanistan that haven't happened yet.
So I was going to point out that talking about passes and also talking about war movies reminded me a lot of the book Jarhead, which got made into the movie with Jake Gyllenhaal. In the book, the author, I'm forgetting his name, but it'll come to me here quickly.
Anthony Swofford.
Anthony Swofford mentions that when the word gets out to the Marines on Camp Pendleton that Saddam Hussein has invaded Kuwait, they are in the middle of a 4-day pass, drunk out of their minds on cheap beer, watching war movies. Because what he pointed out is that all the war movies about Vietnam are supposed to make you appreciate the folly of war. But if you're a 19-year-old Marine, they just look badass. And like all you care about is just like watching movies where people are in the shit, just getting after it, dumping magazines at things. And so they're watching Apocalypse Now and Platoon and Hamburger Hill. And like, you're supposed to feel sad. And there's like, hell yeah, get after it. Like, we want to do this too. So the truth being that most junior enlisted soldiers and Marines probably spend most of their 4-day passes hammered out of their minds in the barracks. And so when I think about war movies or military movies that encapsulate the experience, I feel like it's so iffy, and there's so many times like you can get a movie that does get some things right but gets other things wrong. But one of the best movies in terms of like getting the feel of the military right is a long since forgotten film from 2001 called Buffalo Soldiers, and it's all about the army in Germany and this really shady captain who's basically wheeling and dealing around this base. I think it's Panzerkaserne or Kaiserslautern, but it's the only movie I've ever seen that actually like shows what it's like to train with Miles gear. It shows like the stupidity of being in the field and generally just like the stupidity of the weird sort of, it's all really overhyped in a way. Like things are over kind of exaggerated, but watching that movie, it felt like the first time I'd actually seen a movie about the military that was written or in some way influenced by somebody who actually was in the military and was paying attention.
You know, that's interesting. I, for me, the most realistic movie I've ever watched when it comes to the military. I've talked about Generation Kill is the only series that I've watched about our current conflicts that is anywhere near, like, I don't remember, know if you guys remember, like, back in, like, the middle of the surge years when, like, fucking, Stop Loss came out, and then there was that horrible TV show Over There.
Over There, yeah.
Oh my god, that was so bad. Oh god, it starts
Over out There was a show on FX that was all about Iraq, and it was like, it was the weirdest kind of, it's strange to make a war movie or war TV show while the war is still ongoing. And I mean, this was being made in like 05, 06, but let's just say it was like one of those shitty spin-off imitations of ER that came out in the 90s, except it was set in Iraq.
That
I remember watching, go ahead, sorry.
I was saying, all I remember from it was a female soldier who took leave and decided to go AWOL. And then she turned herself in because she was in Las Vegas and hooked up with like a lesbian prostitute, like if another female. So there's this like a shower scene between the two of them, but it's on FX, so it's really not that great. And then she steals all the money from the soldier, and then she goes and turns herself into a recruiter or something. That's like literally all I can remember, just thinking, just like everything, every other part of that show was just so fucking forgettable.
I remember something with an embedded journalist, and like he shows up in the first 10 minutes of the show, and by the 25 minute mark, he's in an orange jumpsuit about to get his head cut off. So like literally every embedded journalist ever apparently gets taken prisoner by Al-Qaeda. But it was really bad, and it was strange, because I think you've got to have distance, I think, when you tell these kinds of stories. Or if there's not distance, it has to be confined to a specific series of events. And so that's why you get, like, I mean, even though the wars aren't over and aren't going to end anytime soon, you have things like Lone Survivor or American Sniper or any of these films that, like, they're set around a specific kind of mythology or a retelling of events. But I honestly haven't seen Generation Kill yet, and I probably should watch it. I've kind of been staying away from it because, like, I remember one of my soldiers was watching it when we were deployed, and he loved it. But for me, I just was sort of, I guess in a sense, it seemed, even just watching over his shoulder on his laptop, it seemed too real. It seemed too accurate. And I was like, I don't really know if I want to watch this, because it's probably going to, like, for me, like my sort of mental release with regard to war movies is watching Vietnam movies, just because like the good ones are accurate and there's something familiar, but also like I wasn't in Vietnam. So it's not like,
well, it's, you know, the accuracy, it manages to get the accuracy of war, which includes the absurdity of it, the weirdness of the command. And also, like, it seems like almost every episode kind of ends on the Humvee, the convoy driving, and them, you know, the Marines just singing some stupid song at the top of their lungs. Like, one of them, they're singing Teenage Dirtbag and hitting all the falsetto spots. Like, it's a fantastic show just because it is, you know, it doesn't do the whole, I guess, like when war movies try to be like, what is it all about? What is this war all about? What does Vietnam mean? And this is just, we are in some shit and we're just surviving it. And we're going to have as much fun as we can while we do it.
Yeah. So, I mean, if there's a country or a movie that's partly responsible for the both the successes and the problems of the war movie genre, it's probably All's Quiet on the Western Front, like that, the original German black and white, I guess, movie of the book by the same name. And, you know, it's a great war movie. You watch it. I remember watching it in eighth grade and sort of not paying attention. I think I was hitting on a girl or something. And then watching it again in high school and thinking like, wow, this is really good. And then watching it again after college and like confirming that high school opinion of it, being like, this is a movie that's about a country's perception of itself going to war. And most of the movies since then have been kind of responses to that war movie, which is like, you know, which is basically a Bildungsroman, like the coming of age story for the young man. And, but since Band of Brothers, you know, like the TV series, once and TV, like the maturation of like the TV serial in general, I think it's really hard to, and one of the reasons that like movies of Iraq or Afghanistan for me anyway, keep hitting, swinging and missing, is that it's too narrow now, in part because Iraq and Afghanistan, what were they about? Like you were saying, like, I don't know. Like we're still seeing it. We're not sure what it's about. It's about a question.
That was one of the things that's interesting to me too, is that like the New York Times recently put out a list of like their top movies of the 21st century so far. And the Hurt Locker featured really high on there. And it's always kind of strange to me to watch the adulation that's heaped upon the Hurt Locker, because while I do think that it gets the costumes and the environment, the ambiance, right, dude, the best comparison to the accuracy of that plot is like, it's like reading medieval French literature where the hero like somehow manages to kill 500 Saracens with one sword at the same time. Like, it's so absurd. It's like watching elephants dancing on unicycles. And then it kind of goes back to being a serious war movie. But then you're like, oh, three guys are going to hold off a fucking company size element. Like three guys are going to clear this massive factory together. Like all this, just this guy just runs out into Baghdad, just goes jogging to go to like, he's like, oh, I was at a whorehouse. Like what the fuck is any of that? It's so insane.
That's a great comparison, because so often, you know, in studying literature at university, I found myself reading a book, the reason behind which, the reason I was reading this book ended up being, it's the first example of such and such. And you're like, if this is the first example of modern English, as we understand it because X, Y, and Z, okay. You know, there's some utility to that, to understanding like what text has been, assigned as the integral text for this period, like the one that fits the most issues into it and is most evocative / most representative. But those are always boring. It is sort of, like the Pilgrim's Progress, I get it. It's useful for understanding allegory and metaphor. It's useful for understanding how a 16th or 17th century person might have thought in what was a city at that time. But, watching The Hurt Locker, you're just like, you were the first, this is the first movie to tackle Iraq. Like, you missed, Iraq as a concept went into the end zone and spiked the ball and did an end zone dance. And you were there looking fucking humiliated. You got smoked, dude. You got smoked, Hurt Locker. Sorry, go ahead.
I'd also like to speak to the accuracy of The Hurt Locker. As Nate was saying, first off, during one of the scenes in The Hurt Locker, they're seen playing an Xbox 360. Now, the Xbox 360 was not released until late 2005. Yet somehow, in early 2004, or late 2004, early 2005, they have a hold of a Xbox 360. Furthermore, the Humvees that these gentlemen are using have the LED headlights. LED headlights were not put onto the Humvees until much later in the Iraq War. So accuracy kind of out the window with The Hurt Locker.
Again, compare it to that Samuel L. Jackson movie where like he's walking around with a poncho as a cape. I mean, come on, man. Like his rank changes from like full bird colonel to like brigadier general back and forth between scenes. I mean, like if you measure it against that for accuracy, The Hurt Locker is like the most stately presentation of the military. It's still a ridiculous plot, but...
No, the best movie about the military that has ever gotten everything right about basic training, the absurdity of deployment, the stupidity of dealing with special forces, when you're just a pogue-ass motherfucker, is Pauly Shore's In the Army Now, which I have written about. I will be posting the link to it. It is one of my favorite pieces that I've ever written because it's absolutely true. It's the best movie that depicts the military. Because it's all shot at Fort Sill. It is all shot in mid-90s basic training.
I was just going to say, I want to ask before we close it out, what's everybody's favorite war movie? Mine is Apocalypse Now, and I didn't appreciate it until after the fact. I think it just gets so many things right across the board, and I watched it as a civilian. I watched it as a young lieutenant. Didn't really get it. I came back after deployment a few years. I got out of the Army, and then I watched it again, and I was like, holy shit, this gets closer to the sort of platonic ideal of a war movie, as I understand it, than anything else I've ever seen.
Thin Red Line.
Starship Troopers.
Good one. Hey, you know what? Starship Troopers was parodic to the point of seeming absurd when it came out, and now you watch it, you're like, oh, wow, this guy really understood America.
It's so fucking good, like, when you watch it. And then you skip the second one, but you watch the third one. Third one's not better, but the third one's good, too.
Another really good one is Paths of Glory, and it's good because you've got this crazy showdown between, great war movies are great for the same reasons that great movies are great, which is that they do the things that movies are supposed to do well. Like there's good characterization. The people are believable. They don't, it's not fetishization of some aspect of the military, usually violence for violence's sake. And Paths of Glory has this amazing scene at the end with, which if you don't watch the rest of the movie, you should just watch that part where the, Kirk Douglas? Yeah, Michael Douglas's father. Kirk Douglas is this lawyer who's tried to get a lawyer and a brigade commander, like a colonel. He's tried to get these soldiers off. They're going to be executed for cowardice, even though it's not their fault. It's the brigade commander's fault. This awful brigade commander, who's a brigadier general, and the brigadier general, his boss, like the division general, thinks that Kirk Douglas's character is trying to get the brigadier general's job. He's a cynic, so he thinks that Kirk Douglas's character is cynical, and he thinks that he's playing politics. So he executes the guys, but he holds the brigadier general responsible. And Kirk Douglas, was trying to get his guys off because he believed that they were innocent. And he has this incredible showdown with the division commander where he just curses him out. And he's like, I'll never be with like you. You're a horrible person. You sent my men out to die. Fuck you. And the division commander is like, oh, I didn't realize you, my dear man, you're an idealist. And then he's like, we'll never talk about this again. Like, go back to your men. We're sending you back to the front. He doesn't take it personally because he's cynical. And it's just so amazing that like, that's what the military is on a certain level. It's these egotists who don't really understand each other's motivations. It's like, oh, you're an idealist. I had no idea. I would have let the men go if I'd known that you were an idealist. I thought you wanted the Brigadier General's job. I was going to give you a promotion. I love that.
That your British accent is interesting, Adrian. It's better. It's like you're not even trying.
They're
but it's
French.
Good.
No. They're French. So they're British people okay. Playing French people.
Well, on that note, I think I want to have Adrian only speak in a British French accent from now on. Everyone in our audience knows he's a cultured European compared to us. But yeah, I feel like this is productive. I'm gonna go watch some movies now because it's the 4th of July weekend.
Yeah. I'm gonna go get some America labeled Budweisers and just get absolutely trashed. All right, so everybody, be sure to follow us on Facebook, follow us on Twitter. You can find both of the links in the show notes. We've got lots and lots of bonus content already out there, and we've got plenty more coming. I know Nate and Adrian and myself all have interviews lined up, so we've got a lot of stuff that we're going to be stringing out pretty soon. And hopefully we're going to start doing more fun episodes like this so that we're not all – because it just brings me down sometimes talking about – how shit the military can be. So we'll do some fun stuff. And on that note, everybody, I hope that all of your fingers are still intact. I hope that everybody didn't drink or drive this weekend. Well, you can drink, just don't drive. And, somebody should probably give a safety brief.
Yeah, Adrian, you're the company commander. But before we get the safety brief, I just wanted to say... click on the Patreon link because that money, believe it or not, helps us a lot to support things like getting equipment for interviews, hooking people up to, be able to be on our show and so on and so forth. And it makes the content more interesting. We really appreciate the subscribers and we'd love to have more of them. So that's always there. Safety brief.
Damn it. You're putting me on the spot. You know, I had a lingo thing down and I didn't just delegate it to the first sergeant. I guess the most important points are make sure there isn't a ring on it. Check for the ring, check the driver's license to make sure that she's above age. I was in an all-male unit, so if she doesn't have a driver's license, you probably shouldn't try to do anything illegal or possibly illegal with her. I'm realizing my safety brief is really geared to
our safety briefs are so sex. They're so sexist.
Safety brief.
All right, everybody. Long weekend.
This is going to be releasing. This is releasing on the 5th anyway. So you're long gone anyway at this point. It doesn't matter.
The funny thing about the safety brief is you would think that it would be sufficient to say, don't do anything I wouldn't do. But if you're the type of person who thinks through things that you wouldn't do, then that rule already doesn't apply to you. Like the worst safety brief that I had to sit through was one that lasted 45 minutes. But we had to do it because so many stupid things had happened that the company commander and first sergeant went through like exhaustively a series of things that you should not or could not do because of things that people had done in the recent past, including get in a fight with 15 Moroccans, one of whom was carrying a samurai sword. Can't make this stuff up. Can't make it up. So don't get in a fight with a Moroccan who's carrying a samurai sword. If that doesn't seem obvious to you, well, this safety brief isn't for you then. It's for somebody else sitting next to you or in the house right over.
All right, fall in on your, what will you say? All right, I'm the commander, fall in on your platoon leaders or your first line supervisors, and they'll take the safety brief from here, which means you're going to do 15 more minutes of the same goddamn thing.
Right.
Yep. All right, gentlemen, take care. We'll talk to you next week.
Yeah. Bye-bye.